This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 36. I'm delighted to be joined by Chris Rica, CEO and co-founder of iWOCA. iWOCA is a fintech lender, but not a P2P. They raise finance and then can lend it out themselves, a direct lending model which has many advantages, as we all hear. Wikipedia gives a nice summary. iWOCA Limited is an online finance company based in London. It offers credit facilities to small businesses trading in the UK, Poland, Spain and Germany. It also partners with Alibaba to offer a trade finance product, e-credit line, to businesses purchasing from Chinese suppliers. Chris and CTO James Deer founded iWOCA in October 2011, and the company started trading in March 2012. Initially, iWOCA offered credit exclusively to e-commerce businesses. However, in April 2014, it expanded its criteria and started to lend to all types of small business. iWOCA provides loans of up to £100,000 and assesses risks based on data taken directly from eBay, Amazon, PayPal, SagePay, business bank accounts and other online and offline platforms. A 3% monthly interest rate and maximum loan term of 12 months are typical. To date, iWOCA has lent over £50 million across 8,000 transactions and has around 100 people in London. There's plenty to talk about in terms of this model of direct lending, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Chris. Thanks for joining me today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me to your podcast.
And thanks for inviting me to your ping pong table, where we're currently seated at the moment. As we were saying, the office is quite full with staff. And a year ago, I was talking about the trend for ping pong tables and football tables in FinTech and Barclays Accelerator and these kind of places. I see less of them these days, and when I do see them, rather like today's, people don't actually have the time to use them. So
there's plenty of use of our ping pong and pool tables and table soccer tables. If you stick a little bit longer, then you will see that they're well used.
Okay, well, depending on how long this recording takes, if listeners hear a click-clock, click-clock, click-clock in the background, you'll know that the ping pong has started while we're talking. So you presumably didn't always spend your life sitting at a ping pong table doing direct lending to all of these countries. So what's your journey been from, well, we can fast forward from a baby and a toddle a bit, but what's your professional journey been to get to where you are today?
When I was at university, I always had this dream that I would have an impact on this world in some shape or form, at least. And when I left university, I joined Goldman, where I thought that would be a good place to start, given that it's a company that does rather punchy transactions and does have an impact on the world, and I wanted to be part of that. And then over the years, I realized that I became a very small part of a very, very big organization that has an impact on the world. And I was longing for something that, you know, I felt I could have a more direct impact through my actions. And therefore, I've chosen to set up my own business. And I was incredibly excited by putting my own passion about small businesses and getting funding to them to a larger structural problem. And that's how my career has evolved.
And so when you were coming up with the original model, you would presumably have known of the likes of Zopo and the likes of RateSetter and Funding Circle were probably still quite young businesses these days. What was the inspiration and how did you choose the business model that you've ended up with, which, as I said in the introduction, is relatively rare compared to the sort of more photocopied approach of peer-to-peer lending?
I was very excited about peer-to-peer at the time, and you know, still think these are thriving businesses. So that's back in 2011. FinTech then was much less in the spotlight than it is today, and all of these platforms, as you say, they were very young. As a matter of fact, I had played with the thought of setting up a fund that would raise funding and then invest into full loans, originated by exactly those platforms.
So a bit like P2P GI has done with the Investment Trust.
Exactly. So I would have set up one of the earliest funds in that field, and therefore I had the opportunity to speak to a lot of these businesses directly when they were much smaller relative to what they are today. And at the time, you had already this trend in the US that more institutional customers were interested in investing into full loans, from insurance companies to hedge funds to banks. And I saw the angle of my previous role at Goldman that I would know this field relatively well. And so would probably be able to execute that opportunity.
Which area were you at Goldman's?
I was part of the fixed income division, and my clients included pension funds, corporates, and insurance companies. So I spent, before I started Avoka, I did spend some time at Smava, the German peer-to-peer platform, one of the earlier ones. And it was very insightful, you know, to see sort of firsthand how they've been building the business. I ended up deciding that I wanted to have a more operational role. So I decided against raising a fund and investing through these platforms and felt that there was a very large opportunity related to small business lending, which, you know, none of the platforms at the time were really addressing. Keep in mind, 2011 was the year where Funding Circle launched, if I'm not mistaken. So they were very, very young and at the very beginning of their journey. And small business lending in particular was a field that was a lot less covered by fintech then.
Andrew from Funding Circle was on the show a couple of shows ago, and he was talking about the thinking when they were launching. And he mentioned a company whose name slips my mind now, who was just slightly ahead of them in terms of peer-to-peer, who's now disappeared in terms of lending. But given all the excitement these days around, as you say, fintech and all that, it's very easy to forget that a few years ago it didn't really exist.
That's true. And Andrew was certainly one of the figures at the time that I found incredibly impressing in this sort of journey ahead of setting up my own business. He was very inspiring and had a lot of experience in running a lending operation and a peer-to-peer one in particular.
Yes, and in terms of ping pong, every time I go into Funding Circle, they've got more trophies showing how well they're doing in ping pong. So not only are they busy raising 150 million through your prior employer, but they actually also find the time to be good at ping pong. Either that or they just directly recruit people who are good at ping pong.
That leads me sort of to the challenge of seeing if we can't organize something to see which team is ahead, at least on the ping pong table.
Indeed. So moving on to the table of lending money out, maybe you can just explain a little bit, as I say, because listeners will, of course, be familiar with what a bank is and that it lends money, and equally listeners will be familiar with peer-to-peer or marketplace players. So how does the direct lending model, if we want to call it that for the sake of some words, how does the direct lending model work in comparison with, say, a bank or a peer-to-peer? What's the sort of similarities and differences?
Before I can answer that question, I need to give you a little bit more background on why we had chosen a direct lending model in the first place. So our focus is on small businesses, and despite having had years of quantitative easing and record amounts of liquidity hitting the markets and banks in particular, you have seen a continuous contraction of loan volume to small businesses. And while policymakers were trying to get funding and channel funding exactly sort of to that segment, the data points to the opposite happening. And if you take this as a conclusion, it doesn't seem to be liquidity lacking in the market to solve the bottleneck of small business lending. And that's why we felt that the problem is much more related to the cost of underwriting and bringing down the cost of underwriting for a small business loan, making the proposition for a lender more attractive to lend to them in the first place. The second angle is it's a higher risk segment, so understanding the risk of incredibly heterogeneous group of, in the UK, 5 million small businesses is of critical importance. So that brings me back to the direct lending model. We set up the business by focusing much more on the underwriting techniques in the customer segment that generally is smaller to what a marketplace or a bank caters to, for exactly the reason that there has been much less innovation in bringing down that cost.
Okay, so just pausing there and going through the two statements. I mean, as you say, the cost of underwriting is key, and the various changes in regulation of banks over the last few years, certainly since the crisis, have increased their cost of underwriting because it's increased the amount of capital they require, the amount of regulatory overload and all that kind of thing. And as you say, that the whole fintech sector can be much more efficient by having a more digital approach. In the podcast before this one, John Goodall from Landbay was talking about stress testing peer-to-peer portfolios. And one of the interesting things to me, coming from a risk background, was that the risk in the portfolio is relatively limited. You know, using the Bank of England stress test data, even in very difficult circumstances, investors should only be losing a relatively small sum of money and nowhere near their interest rate gain. And it occurred to me that one of the reasons for that is simply that a bank is, these days, a very expensive way of channeling liquidity from one place to another. So I think we can certainly agree that doing it in a more efficient way is a winner for all of these kind of businesses, whether it's peer-to-peer or marketplace or direct lending. The interesting thing, coming on to your second point, is in terms of assessing the risk. Again, when Andrew was on a couple of weeks ago talking about Funding Circle, off the top of my head, rightly or wrongly, I recall him saying that basically the arithmetic works out that they've got half a day to do due diligence on their average deal, something like that. So they need a process which can allow for that. In terms of what you're saying about there's a segment that's not really served by peer-to-peer slash marketplaces, presumably you need to be even more efficient than that, certainly on the smaller end of your loans. Like, yeah. If you're lending £1,000, for example, you can't spend £1,000 doing due diligence.
That's right. That's the absolute correct conclusion. And by focusing on the smaller size customers, we have to make an extra effort in making the processes as efficient as they possibly can while understanding the risk.
And when you say small, what do you mean? Because everyone says SME, but defines S in terms of small to medium enterprises in a different way.
Our customers tend to have less than a handful of employees. They tend to do a bit more than £100,000 in annual revenues. And we cater to businesses that do up to £2 million in annual revenues, which is generally sort of when banks start at above £2 million to classify them as a business customer. So we would target, with our product, we would target small businesses that would mostly be classified as a consumer within a bank that has a business attached to it.
That's interesting, and actually kind of explains the profile of pictures of your kind of case studies on your website that I was looking at on my phone. They seem to be younger people doing smaller things, and I can quite see that is a segment that isn't served. So that also, going back to your background in fixed income, of course, and what you've been doing here for several years, we assume successfully, given that, as you'll tell us later, you've been growing very well and people are quite happy to give you even more money on the funding side of it. That presents an interesting challenge in terms of how does one assess the risk of half a dozen folk sitting in a building without a huge trading history, and clearly assessing the risk is the key to the whole thing.
Absolutely. So the assessment of the risk comes in a number of stages. And the model that the traditional lenders had is just not been up to date anymore of, you know, what a good sort of user experience can be delivered by a more modern company. And so we felt it was important to rethink the entire process. So the first bit of risk assessment is the way how you're collecting information about your customers. And that's a very, very relevant part of your initial due diligence. And as a technology company, we have built a number of integrations with data sources that provide us with very standard information about a company through public sources, including databases like Companies House here in the UK, but also to integrate a number of domain-specific information sources that tell us more about a specific style of a business applying to us. So the real struggle that you have is, how can you understand 1 out of 5 million possible companies coming to you? Yeah. And we have built integrations, for example, with e-commerce platforms to understand retailers better. And we have built integrations with payment processors to understand hospitality, restaurants, and similar companies better. So the way how we innovated in risk assessment is to be able to understand the customer in a significantly more comprehensive and granular way at the point where they're applying to us at our website, and all of that within a few clicks and minutes, rather than through very lengthy manual forms.
Yes, it's interesting, and just listening to you talk about that, it occurs to me that in terms of kind of what you might want to say is the precision with which you can know what the risk is, the precision is much lower than, this may not be a good example, than if we're assessing, for example, IBM or BP. You know, there's a lot of information about IBM or BP, there's a lot of trading history. For the sake of argument, we can assume they're going to be around in a year's time. I mean, they might not be, but it would be very, very strange circumstances. And so I assume that, for example, if there's an error bar around your risk assessment, that then feeds back into needing a bit of a buffer in the interest rates. So if you're lending to AAA companies, the spread of rates will be fairly low. I assume if you're lending to these small companies, the spread of rates might be quite wide. Because, for example, let's say you're lending to the London FinTech podcast so I can buy some new, bigger, better microphones. It might be quite hard to pin down what the risk really is. I mean, of course, it's terrible, but I mean, I don't want to tell you that in case I do need to borrow some.
Well, of course, we would be delighted to work with you to help you expand your business and finance any sort of acquisition of new equipment or marketing to have more people listen to this podcast.
Absolutely. Hopefully your due diligence would throw up the fact that I charge people nothing for being on the show and I charge listeners nothing for listening to it. So the the cash flow of the podcast bit isn't entirely healthy. But coming back to the basic point then, do you find that there is a wide dispersion of interest rates that you know your clients are paying?
If you think of the risk, that's one cost of the business. And the core costs that any lending operation has are coming from three sources. One is the customer acquisition, which tends to be relatively high in the lending space. The second is related to your risk and provisions that you need to create for every single customer. And the third one is related to your funding costs that fuel your loan growth. So risk being one important cost factor, and yes, in the small business space, you tend to have a higher risk segment, and then you have a huge dispersion of risk in this segment, which traditional lenders have no real sort of ability to price because they do not have the depths of analytical systems and information about them. And that's a great thing that with the technology that we have developed, we're much, much better at identifying in this sort of huge volumes of small businesses that are out there, which ones are lower risk and which ones are higher risk. Yeah. And so you can price them accordingly. But there is a fairly big discrepancy of a small business having a very low default probability versus one that has a much higher. And as you know, you probably have seen in other studies, for companies that are particularly young, only 80% make it through their first 3 years. Younger businesses have generally a much higher default rate.
Yeah. So what kind of range of interest rates would companies pay if they are in the segment that you're serving and they come to you? What would the kind of lowest rate be and the highest rate? What's kind of range?
Starting with the lowest rate would be, you know, starting from 13% over a 12-month period versus the highest rate going to about 40% over a 12-month period in our product case. There's an additional dimension that you need to take into consideration when you speak about cost of financing. Traditional products tend to be long-term, 3 to 5 years. Yeah. The reason why sort of traditional lenders prefer longer-term contracts is the visibility of future revenues. So if you base a relatively high upfront cost of underwriting versus the probability of covering this cost, traditionally, you would opt for a longer term because the longer term revenues would be higher after projected losses than your upfront cost. And so operating in a shorter term working capital framework would mean that you have a higher cost relative to a long-term loan because the use of the funds might only be for a very short period.
Yeah, which is very similar to something like market invoice, which has got fairly small periods to actually recoup all its costs in.
That's right.
So moving on to the advantages of the model whereby you've raised a bunch of funding and then it's literally sort of sitting in quotes your bank account, and as your website says, you can sometimes lend it out in a matter of hours. That must be a great advantage for the businesses compared to some of the peer-to-peer or marketplace models. For example, Funding Circle, which had an auction process which could last quite a long time and interest rates could vary by a percent or two in the last few days. And I was very interested to see that they've moved on from that. I always thought it was a weakness of the model. Last year in the sort of fintech euphoria of 2014 in London, there was lots of talk about gamification and all that, which I regarded as rather silly in the context of people running businesses. If you're an FD, you don't want to play a game. You want to know that your funding rate will be 16% or 17%. Presumably, one of the advantages of the direct lending model is speed and is precision. You can tell me, yes, Mike, we can lend to you and this is the rate. You're not sort of organising some process and saying, oh, we'll get the process running and we'll see how it goes and in a week's time, you know, we'll know where we get to.
Yeah, absolutely. That's certainly a key benefit of being able to set the rate directly ourselves and being able to execute on that instantly. I would sort of add an important point to that. We're dealing with small businesses. Generally, sort of the businesses tend not necessarily be recognized as such by banks or marketplaces. And these small businesses, they don't tend to have a finance function. And the business owner doesn't necessarily have a financial background either. Yeah. They're good at their product level. They're good at retailing and buying their product. But they're not particularly sort of interested in the sort of longer term financial aspect, and therefore the process of sort of an auction, the process of sort of going through something that they need some time to familiarize themselves.
Absolutely.
Might not be wanted. So I think from a customer-centric point of view, all you want is to have financing naturally embedded into your businesses. And I think we're not quite there yet, neither the marketplaces nor the banks.
Yes, I very much agree. I mean, and the other downside of this silly phrase, gamification, is that if it's a game, there's a way of playing it well and there's a way of playing it badly. And as you say, in small businesses, but even small to medium businesses, they've got more important stuff to do than learn the right strategy for playing a game when they need funding every now and then. It's much easier to come to you guys. And do you take any kind of security from these businesses, or typically they don't have very much, or personal guarantees?
The very nature of the customer segment that we are focused on doesn't have a great deal of hard securities. Yeah. And if you're a retailer and you have a few thousand pairs of shoes, that generally is quite difficult to value and then use as security. So we decided that we do not take charges on assets, and we use a personal guarantee as an additional level of confidence that the main stakeholder in the business would have in his own business, and is a sign to us that there's a very high willingness of repaying us.
And you were saying that you have basically internally, effectively, a provision fund to smooth out your credit history internally.
You can call it a provision fund.
Right. You have an accounting process going on.
We're taking the risk of any transactions ourselves, and yeah, need to make sure that we are managing our financials and our risk in a way that we have a profitable and sustainable business. So absolutely, we are targeting a certain amount of loss and aim to be below that.
Excellent. So moving on from the direct lending model, where I think you've explained it very clearly, and I think listeners hopefully can see the advantages and where it fits in. It's been a very exciting year for iWalker. I'm always reading things about you in the press now and then, saying this exciting thing's happened and that's exciting thing's happened. So do you want to share some of the exciting things you've been through this year?
Yeah, so it's been another huge year for us. We're close to celebrating our fourth birthday from incorporation.
You'll have to go to school next when you're five.
So we sort of slowly come into the toddler space, I guess. But this year has been, you know, another year of exciting news. We came much closer to sort of our vision on how financing should be provided to small businesses in this century by partnering up with Alibaba.
Which is not a very small business these days. It's a very big business.
It is a huge business, and that's why we're particularly proud that we have the opportunity of being able to work with them to provide their small business customers, of which they have millions, with a much better way of accessing financing when purchasing goods from an overseas supplier. And that's the first step in implementing our vision that financing to small businesses should be embedded into the day-to-day operations of that business, so that you do not have to go to a bank anymore to present your business and eventually get financing from them. And so Alibaba was certainly one of the biggest milestones that we have had this year. We were also very fortunate to raise more equity funding and to have Commerzbank and their venture team joining us together with Acton Capital. We are seeing banks as a major facilitator. They have each close to 1 million of our customers as relationships, either through their accounts or credit cards, but sadly don't have the operations and technology to provide them with real business financing. Yeah. So having the first bank giving us the confidence of investing in us was a very big milestone for us. And we continue to show that we want to lead in the industry and be a role model of how financing can be done for small businesses. And it was a very, very exciting journey with the Prime Minister to Southeast Asia.
Oh, you're on that group.
As part of his first big trip after being re-elected. So yeah, 2015 so far has been very exciting, but we're only September and there's still a few months out for more exciting news to come.
Exactly. And that's very impressive. So going forwards, what direction are you looking to do? What big things are you sort of thinking of over the next 12 months? Or are you just going to recover from being so busy this year for a little while and consolidate?
Yes, that would be certainly one option. But I think it's not quite the time yet for me to
take a holiday.
To take a prolonged holiday, although it feels sometimes very overdue. With the new funding we have, we can build out.
And how much funding did you raise? Sorry.
We raised $20 million in equity funding. And that shot of additional funding will enable us to invest more in our marketing channels and continue to scale the model. It will also, of course, help us to continue to progress on our technology platform and investing in more resources and in becoming better and better at the analytics. And finally, not to forget, we're running a pan-European operation.
You just read my mind. I was about to ask you about that.
We're in Poland, Spain, and Germany as well, and all of these operations need a substantial investment as well.
And these are sort of a sales rep office? Are they branch office? Are they subsidiaries? Are they locally regulated or covered under the UK? I mean, what kind of overseas offices are they?
So the really interesting bit about Europe is every country is just very different.
Absolutely, yes, yes.
And I haven't seen much harmonization yet in the credit world. So I think particularly in credit, you have different legislation in every single country. And so every single country, therefore, has its very bespoke setup. And we're operating the operations out of London. So our staff is based here.
So you're doing all the kind of, let's keep it simple, you're doing all the sort of kind of computer thing here, but the legal and regulatory stuff of your overseas offices needs to be done there in the local conditions.
That's right.
Right. Good. Well, it's a very exciting journey that you guys are on in the world of IPO lust in peer-to-peer and lending clubs and Zopas and rate setters and all these people going for a billion and a float over here. It's very easy to overlook the fact that there's some exciting segments that aren't being covered by these big players. These big players are doing what they do very well. And I've always been very interested from a kind of more European vibe in terms of where does employment come from. In the sort of 70s, when I was growing up, I was a toddler in the 60s, but the idea was that companies employed people and companies wouldn't actually try and sack their labour force. You know, they'd let their profits go down or whatever. That's where employment came from. In the 1980s, we had this sort of monetarist free market idea that if you free the markets, then the markets will suddenly create labour. And that lasted a little while. But actually, there's a bit of a vibe at the moment, I feel, a bit of an intellectual vacuum economically for where employment comes from. But there's certainly a bit of a vibe that actually one large and very important part, certainly in the UK, for where employment comes from, is from people actually taking risks, actually being capitalists, going out there, setting up a new business. And I feel what you're doing is giving oxygen to these small little fires to get them going and turn them into medium businesses and employ more people. So I think it's a not just interesting from a fintech perspective, not just interesting from a FS lending perspective, but I think it's also economically and socially significant and making a change to people's lives and creating interesting employment in small companies. So I wish you every success on your journey and thanks for today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. The mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fade in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. way the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight.